It's more fun.
For now, let's just put quotation marks. Obviously, anyway, it's a pleasure to be talking in this workshop. Another answer to your question, I put remedy in the title just to sort of pretend to be part of this workshop. Most of my talks indeed will be about gauge theory, but recent developments, which I only recently joined, but by various people, have illuminated a relationship which to me looks very surprising, where you start with gauge theory in four dimensions, and you end up with a system that seems inherently gravitational in nature. In this particular case, it's Liouville theory, which is a version of two-dimensional quantum gravity. But I'll also be emphasizing at the end, if I have time, a perspective on Liouville theory that's essentially 2 plus 1 dimensional. And I would certainly say it's 2 plus 1 dimensional quantum geometry. Whether you want to call it quantum gravity is another point. But let me just start with the actual motivation, which goes back a long time. And essentially, it goes back to studies of electromagnetic duality, which sort of started in the 70s at the time where people were trying to come to grips with QCD, the fact that it confines, and people started developing ideas that the confinement of quarks indeed can be kind of understood from a dual superconductor point of view, like the Meissner effect. And by the way, in my own education, this sort of played an important role as well. I was an undergraduate student in Utrecht, and I was planning to start studying some field theory. And I remember walking past the desk of a secretary there, and there were preprints of at Hooft, who is one of the people who proposed this kind of dual superconducting picture. It was a preprint which I didn't understand at all, but it was about a special type of ways of deciding whether a theory is confining or not. There was the Wilson loop, which indeed was older, but at Hooft in that paper introduced the at Hooft loop. And since that day, it has been one of my motivations in physics to try and actually compute the expectation values of Wilson and at Hooft loops in some gauge theories, if it were possible, because indeed we know that the Wilson loop decides whether or not a theory is confining if it goes with the area law, but an alternative way of thinking about it would be by, or at least approaching the same question, would be by studying the magnetic dual of the Wilson loop, which is the at Hooft loop. So, now, obviously, as usually with these things, QCD, or the real world, is the hardest case. So, indeed, one starts to simplify things. So, the recent developments are in the context of n equals 2 supersymmetric gauge theories. And this is a case where, indeed, it turns out that for a very general class of gauge theories, one can compute and essentially test electromagnetic duality at a very concrete level and compute the expectation values of Wilson and at Hooft loops. Now, it sort of comes from an unexpected angle. And sort of just to give you a little bit of a diagram of the developments that have been taking place. So this is sort of where the new development sits. But there's motivation that comes from M5 brains. There have been earlier developments which were completely developed independent of this motivation, where people solved, essentially, Liouville theory in two dimensions as a conformal field theory. And there are other people, and I'll mention the names of the various people in a second, that took the gauge theory starting point more seriously, but including the ingredient of supersymmetry, one actually could do some rather powerful calculations and essentially sum the instanton contributions that under certain circumstances were giving the exact answer for partition functions of gauge theories on certain spaces. And somehow, these three ingredients all come together, indeed, in this context of the n equals 2 gauge theories, and most beautifully, if one considers the infrared limit of this class of gauge theories, so that one gets super conformal theories. There's a whole rich structure that's building up here that hangs together very nicely, and where we can extract a lot of useful information. So this connection again goes back 10 years, starting with just explorations of M theory. Witten proposed such a connection, and various people have explored it. But more recently, Gaiotto, in combination with various co-authors, but in a paper that has been cited several times but has not appeared yet, with Moranitsky, has been exploring this particular connection. And then in a paper a couple of weeks ago with Tachikawa and Alde, Gaiotto also pointed out this connection between partition functions of the gauge theory and the Liouville theory. The people that have done these calculations of the instanton sums, which are pretty heroic calculations in their own right, are Nekrasov and Perstun in particular. And various people also, including people in this room, have contributed to this overall picture. Here I should mention the Samolodzikovs and also Teschner as people that have developed the technology of Liouville theory. So building, so this is one of my favorite things to do, is that I'm going to compute something in the end by not doing any work, because all the other people have done the work. And in the end, you put them in the calculations in the right order, and you've obtained a new result. So that's sort of roughly the gist of my talk. Let me summarize again what I'm going to be talking about. So I'll talk a little bit about the n=2, so the electromagnetic duality in n=2, and I'll take this M theory perspective. I'll introduce a few ingredients of 2D conformal field theory, and it will become clear why the two roughly are related. I'll introduce the new ingredient where the Liouville CFT, 4D CFT Liouville correspondence pops up, and then I'll do the computation. And the computation will be of the Wilson, although the Wilson loops were done by Perstun in this class of theories, but the new computation indeed will be of the Hof loops, where we'll be using this correspondence rather heavily, and I'll have some conclusions and open problems at the end. Okay. Any questions at this point? Because now let me go to the M theory story. Now, as we all know, again, electromagnetic duality is a strong weak coupling duality, and most powerfully, one could, by the way, obviously, again, the electromagnetic duality is again interchanging these two things. So if you compute one of these things in a weakly coupled theory, you should not expect to find the same answer in the same weakly coupled theory. You would have to do something with the coupling constant. And if you have a theta angle in the story as well, you combine the coupling constant typically in some combination of this. I think there's a 4 pi there, at least in some normalization, where the gauge coupling parameterizes a complex parameter at tau, where indeed very conveniently we can start thinking about tau as if it's describing the shape of a torus, and then the electromagnetic duality transformations amount to the usual modular transformations of that torus, where these A, B, C, D are integers, and in particular tau to one minus one over tau is one of those transformations. Now, M theory essentially takes a shortcut in trying to explain this symmetry. By virtue of the fact that it has this natural 5 plus 1 dimensional object in its spectrum, It's a bit, can we turn on that light also? Or is that? It's probably this. Is it just scratch? Yeah, it's this string or the ML script. Now, so essentially what one does initially is, again, one is going to be lazy by not necessarily solving any theory in four dimensions. Initially, we're going to define theories in four dimensions by considering the M5 brain theory, and our anticipation is that we're going to be wrapping that M5 brain on a two-dimensional torus to obtain a four-dimensional theory. But before I'll do that, let me say two words about the M5 brain theory itself. So if you take the RR limit, it's in six dimensions, you get a six-dimensional conformal field theory, which actually is the fact that it exists, or at least the fact that we have a lot of evidence that it exists, is one of the surprises that came out of the story of M theory and out of string theory. And that six-dimensional theory we call the 2.0 theory. It's not a very beautiful name, but it's a conformally invariant, superconformally invariant, indeed with 2.0 supersymmetry in six dimensions. And the idea is that the fact that it has that symmetry almost fixes it uniquely. You can have some other parameters to the theory. One thing you could do is you can take n M5 brains. You can take a stack of them. You stack them up like that. And then you build some non-abelian structure that, indeed, in the later application of compactifying to four dimensions, will amount to the non-abelian structure of the corresponding four-dimensional gauge theories. But let's continue exploring the six-dimensional picture. Besides M5 brains, M theory also has M2 brains. And if you look at all the couplings of the M2 brain and the M5 brain to the form fields in 11 dimensions, you discover that very naturally the M2 brain can act and on an M5 brain and produce a string as its boundary. Now, this string indeed is very naturally identified as a degree of freedom on the M5 brain, because the M5 brain, one of the features of this 2.0 theory, is that it has a two-form field B on its world volume. This two-form field has a three-form field strength. Again, by looking at the 11-dimensional supergravity theory, one discovers that this thing is self-dual. So in six dimensions, H is its own Hodge dual. So this is a self-dual two-form field strength. And the name for that string, this string is naturally charged relative to a two-form. It's charged relative to that two-form. But when I say charged, normally you would have to say, well, it's either electrically or magnetically charged. But in this case, because the B field is self-dual, this string is both an electric and a magnetically charged object relative to that two-form. And this thing is called the self-dual string. So the six-dimensional theory is actually, it's pretty hard to get a hold of, precisely because of this particular property, that it has excitations that are both electrically and magnetically charged. So in some sense, it's a theory that sits at coupling constant equal to 1. As I explained earlier, at weak coupling, you could have electrically charged and heavy magnetically charged. But if you have a thing that's both electric and magnetically charged, that's a strongly coupled object in many ways. So again, the way in which people have been sort of exploring this theory is by compactification. So the basic claim is, for now, I guess we'll make it a claim, which has been verified in various ways, that this 2.0 theory on T2 times R4 is equivalent to n equals 4. Super Young-Mills theory in on R4. And of course, one piece of evidence for this are the supersymmetries, are the type of excitations. One can identify all kinds of degrees of freedom in both ends. But in particular, indeed, there's an old conjecture due to Montonen, Olaf, and Osborne that n equals 4 super Young-Mills theory is invariant under this S-duality. But if indeed this correspondence holds, then that's a manifest property, because if you have a geometric torus in your compactification, for sure your theory will be invariant under redefinitions of tau like this. Provided one additional perhaps piece of information is that this tau is really the only piece of geometric information that you care about for this T2. You don't care about its overall size. At least you don't care about its overall size in the infrared limit. So in four dimensions, if you take the infrared limit, then the things only depend on the shape of that torus, which is parameterized by tau. So this you could call a lazy perspective on n equals on S-duality for sure. By the way, again, a very attractive picture, of course, is that these self-dual strings, they're string-like excitations, n equals 4 Young-Mills theory does not have strings. So what those strings naturally would want to do in order to become excitations in four dimensions is to actually wrap themselves around some cycle in this torus, in the internal dimension. So if the string does this, it becomes electric. If it goes like that, it's magnetically charged. Now, if the torus would have a shape like this, where the two cycles are roughly of the same size, then the electric and the magnetic charges are roughly of the same mass, because the mass you would expect to be roughly proportional to the length of this cycle over here. Although I was claiming that eventually this thing will go to zero size, which is true in the superconformal limit where everything is massless. But nonetheless, again, the perturbative degrees of freedom of the theory have to be associated with the thing that are naturally becoming light. And so therefore, the perturbative limit, which corresponds to tau to infinity when g goes to zero, corresponds to a torus that looks like this, again, where the electrically charged object are much smaller, a small cycle, whereas the magnetically charged object corresponds to this long cycle. No, so the claim is that if you have n of these M5 brains, you really have the non-abelian symmetry, because this M2 brain here, in this case, I have a charge relative to this eigenvalue. But if this thing stretches between various brains, then you get non-abelian charged matter that lives on the off diagonal. So the claim is indeed that the B field gives rise to the Cartan elements of the matrix of the gauge field, whereas these M2 brains that stretch between the brains give rise to the off diagonal charged object. Yes.
The two sphere has a little bit not quite enough structure.
So it's an interesting question.
We'll be talking about spheres, but spheres with punctures.
That's good.
So let me say it this way. The torus is kind of a little bit of a borderline case, in part because indeed we're going to be looking at space-time where this thing becomes an arbitrary Riemann surface. Mm-hmm. Now, what's going to be a little bit dangerous about the sphere is that we know that there are conformal filling factors that act on the sphere. So it's kind of an ungated fixed theory. So by putting punctures on the sphere, you divide out by the isometries, essentially, and one can identify theories in four dimensions that correspond to the sphere with punctures.
Okay. But you've got this non-abelian electromagnetic fluxes. They have to commute with each other. Is that included in the story? Some of this is beautiful centralization, not just electric magnetic charges.
That they have to be mutually local.
Well, they have to, even in the Lyon, well, they have to commute with each other.
Right, yeah. So, in the story, clearly it is. Again, there's a whole elaborate story where, of course, going back to Gordon, Knights, and Olive, following the other papers, where if you look at the charge letters, there's a corresponding analytically charged letters. And there's a program that people are developing now, motivated even by mathematics, where Witten has been pushing the idea that electromagnetic duality has to do with this mysterious Langlands duality, because it was now what we call the GNO dual is called in math literature the Langlands dual. Actually, the story that I'm telling here, I think, is probably the most practical framework, at least from a physics perspective, for this Langlands duality program. But all of this, indeed, will eventually, I think, will be explored. I should say, though, that the Liouville theory connection is going to be working for a rather simple class of gauge groups where it's SV2. So I'll be considering mostly in the short n equals two brains and five brains. But in principle, you can do it for general. Other questions?
I didn't understand your comment about gauge fixing the isometries of the internal space. They're not gauge symmetries, they're global symmetries. There's nothing to gauge fix.
It's a the reason I say call it gauge fix, it's a non-compact global symmetry. And a non-compact global symmetry, if it acts on a compact... That's my suspicion of why it may not necessarily make sense put the M5 brain on it. Another reason, perhaps, is that a distinction between, which is obviously related, the sphere. The torus, again, as I said, is a marginal case because it's flat. But as soon as you have sufficiently many punctures on it, the surface naturally is defined as a negatively curved space. And it seems that these theories more naturally want to live on. So let's talk briefly about that generalization. So where this Now, so in principle, you could, indeed, once you have a six-dimensional theory, you're not forced to use a torus to go to two dimensions. You can use any two-dimensional compactification manifold, and you can even put punctures on them. On it, what those punctures correspond to? Again, if you put the negative curved metric on this thing, they correspond to sort of spikes that appears out of this surface, and those spikes. You have to think about them essentially because the M5 brain you have to think about is being wrapped on this Riemann surface. And then if there are spikes that go perpendicularly away from it, they're sort of like orthogonal M5 brains. And we'll be making a guess essentially, or a dictionary between what four-dimensional theory one gets out of this, and essentially you would like to identify a gauge theory for every Riemann surface with functions. Okay?
So if the Riemann surface is non-compact, you see there's still dynamics of normalizable modes, which is effectively four-dimensional theory, and is that the right? But usually if you compactify in a non-compact thing, you don't get...
Oh, you mean you're thinking about this puncture as non-compact?
No, it's a big horn. I mean,
it's a big horn.
What is the definition of a puncture?
Yes, right.
Yeah, what's the definition of a puncture? The definition of a puncture is that indeed it's a... So later on we're going to be talking about... Liouville theory on this space. I would say the more honest origin of this particular language goes back to essentially Sargreaves Witten. Famous paper where they specify the infrared behavior of n equals 2 Jamil's theory in terms of data that can be parameterized in terms of some curve, which you call the Sargreaves-Witten curve. And it turns out that if you add additional matter to your gauge theory, that the corresponding data involve indeed a differential, a one-form on this Riemann surface, that is allowed to have certain poles. So it's defined on it, but since it has poles, those poles are called functions. And the residue of the pole is the mass of the corresponding metric field in the four-dimensional gate. So this is a dictionary that Sadek and Witten, by clever reasoning, uncovered. And people like Nekrasov were persistent enough to take the story of Sadek and Witten and not just take it at face value, but actually try to derive it from doing an honest gauge theory computation. So Sadek and Witten derived an effective action of the infrared theory, which suggested a certain instanton sum of it, instanton contributions, and Nekrasov in some cases was able to reproduce or derive that expression. So that's where it is.
But in the cyber written framework, the functions are the things that look in type 2A like the non compact five frames.
You think about them as those brains. Okay. It's true when I see those brain pictures like that and that. I have the same question as you. What happens to all those modes that are walking up? But in this case. That's sort of what I like about this. I tend to think about this still as a compact space. So if I can imagine wrapping the M5 brain on this compact space and just trying to extract what the four-dimensional gauge theory is. Now we have an important hint if we want to know what the gauge theory on this space is, namely that the perturbative gauge theory in Ennicott's Fourier nodes corresponds to the case, to the regime, where this torus becomes very long. So if I would take the perturbative limit of this M theory in four dimensions where there might be a gauge theory, a weakly coupled gauge theory description, then I want to draw this thing by means of thin tubes connected via sort of a plumbing setup or a sewing setup where I take the tubes and draw this Riemann surface like that, say. This goes like that. This goes like that. Do I have another color? I probably don't. Yes. So what's a natural thing to do? Since one single gauge group, which is Ennicott's Fourier nodes, in some ways corresponds to a single tube, let's divide this up into vertices and tubes. So I have these regions inside of it, my green circles. These green regions, which are the name for that in terms of Riemann surface theory, is trinium or a pair of pins. And you have them connected by tubes. And the dictionary, essentially the conjecture dictionary, would be that for every thin tube, there's a gauge group that corresponds to it. So if I have n five brains, I would have an SUN gauge theory, gauge group associated with that tube. This pair of pins that's connecting each of these tubes, I'll think about that and I'll motivate it maybe in a second, as matter. One way of thinking about why this corresponds to matter is that, as I told you, this theory has an M2 brain. Let me see if I can say this clearly. Let me postpone that question. But roughly, I'm saying that if you would wrap the self-dual string on this trinion over here, over this region here, essentially what you get is you can see that you get an operator, that a local operator that's charged under these two, three gauge groups. So this is what we would call trifundamental matter, meaning it's charged under the fundamental representations of the three SU2, SUN gauge group that correspond to whatever sits on the other side. Yeah, here.
not so much here, but here.
I'm not wrapping the string, I'm wrapping the full world sheet around this particular, on this thing. And I'll draw the picture later.
So the matter comes from wrapped strings.
Yes, but local operators come from completely wrapped.
Oh, yeah, the gauge invariant. Things which are gauge invariant operators in the lower dimensional. Right. But if you're talking about trifundamental matter, that's not a gauge invariant field.
It's not a gauge invariant field. So you have to attach it to Wilson loops, and that's actually what we're going to be talking about. And again, these external tubes correspond to fundamental matter. So essentially, by looking at this diagram, one kind of can extract information about what the gauge theory looks like. And one name that one could give to this gauge theory is that it's a generalized quiver gauge theory. But that's not, that name is not that important. Quiver just means that there's a certain way of parameterizing, which essentially is done by this diagram, the way the matter is charged on the various gauge loops. But the more important point is actually that if I give you a Riemann surface with punctures here, then there are actually many ways in which I can draw it as a way of having many of these thin tubes. So this theory, although it exists sort of more in general, the idea is that the four-dimensional theory is going to be parameterized by the shapes of this Riemann surface. So the coupling constants of the four-dimensional gauge theory, where is it? The coupling constants of the gauge theory and let me call it again a four-dimensional superconformal field theory. There's one, what this construction does is that it's given by the moduli space of complex structures. On sigma, the moduli space of complex structures on Riemann surfaces. Now, this moduli space itself, again, let me draw it suggestively like that. So it looks like that. So it has many corners, and each of those corners correspond to a version of this Riemann surface that will look like that. But again, there are different gauge theories that are sitting at these different corners, and there are relations between them.
Herman, why is it conformal?
So by definition, so that's what we're going to do. We put it on this surface, on this six-dimensional space. Initially, this thing has a size, maybe has a scale, but I'm going to take the infrared limit. I'm interested in the infrared.
So, but what are the conditions to have an interesting fixed point?
I would just say, whatever evidence one starts to accumulate that this identification is correct will tell you that the fixed point would have to be non-trivial.
No, I mean, in general, in Cyber-Witten theory, you don't. Most of the time you get a non... I mean, even the ones that have a traditional description, you know, like N equals 2 with hypers, usually the number of flavors is wrong, and you flow to something that's, you know, asymptotically free, and it confines, or it has a free magnetic rate or something.
There are, and for general N equals 2 superconformal theories, let's just say this way, the UV theory and the IR theory are very different.
Right.
I'm not saying that those are necessarily the same. The basic, and I admit that, okay, I would like to have a somewhat more precise argument for this. But the basic argument that one needs to keep an eye on is that the in the infrared, so we start with a six-dimensional theory that's conformally invariant. Okay. Now this thing introduces a scale, the size of that compactification manifold. But then again, we're going to remove that scale by going to the infrared limit, which means that the infrared limit is parameterized by just the conformal invariant data on this Riemann surface. So it's indeed it is labeled by the Monod space.
Classically, yes, but quantum mechanically, that argument, as you know, doesn't work.
I would say if the quantum mechanics, okay, if it looks like this, right, where indeed there are corners where the theory becomes perturbative, then quantum mechanics is not quite as frightening as when you're sitting in the middle. So the fact that the whole thing is being attached in the corners in perturbative limits,
I guess I don't quite still understand. I mean, the Seiberg-Witten theory, the usual one, is in this general category of things, and it's not conformal. I don't understand what special property you're using of the theories you're interested in.
Yeah, this thing should not be called the Seiberg-Witten curve, although I was viewing it as... And the perspective, actually, that Gajoto, Moore, and Nitzky are taking is one level of subtlety beyond what Seiberg and Witten did. They honestly look at the n-fold cover of this space, and the n-fold cover of the space has more data than the Seiberg-Witten curve.
So the usual Seiberg-Witten theory is not in this class?
Yes, the usual Seiberg-Witten theory is not in this class. Okay. So this is not really literally the Seiberg-Witten.
Okay, so everything in here is conformal.
Right. And I think that's the basic new ingredient, because to some extent, this is something that the general picture that I'm describing is something that people 10 years ago already strongly suspected, but to actually sort of identify more cleanly that there is still this non-trivial. In that respect, it's an important question. Simply the fact that there is this non-trivial class of theories is an important realization.
So to summarize, this is a conjecture which you might be able to check in the corners, and then from there on you
can deliver. Yes, you can try to probe these various relations. By the way, I should mention a couple of examples here. So there's indeed the n equals 4, which I mentioned. Then there's a thing called the n equals 2 star, where you take n equals 4 Young nodes and you give a mass to... some of the flavors. So it's a deformation with a mass parameter of the n plus 4 Young Mills, which is the one punctured torus in this dictionary. Or if you take the sphere with four punctures, this is just pure gauge theory, but then with four flavors. So a single gauge node with four flavors. And again, this isn't super conformally invariant. So these are examples where at least we know that the infrared limit exists. Although in this case it's not really conformally invariant because it's a mass deformation, but here it exists as a conformally invariant.
But for three punctures or five punctures, it's not.
Yeah, now five punctures, again, of course, you just add. Three punctures is a little bit mysterious. If you take the sphere with just three punctures, it's a theory with just matter. No guessing, because there are no twos. There's only a thing with three. So it's just a theory of matter, which in itself is an interesting component of most.
So the n equals 4 is only conformal for SU2, right? It's only SU2 with four flavors. So for arbitrary.
Yeah, so you're right. So the actual dictionary that I'm writing there. In the end, in terms of this generalized Clifford data, it's really just for SU2. It turns out that if you do this more generally for SU3 and for SUn, you need something that doesn't strictly have a Lagrangian description. Although people have presented arguments that the corresponding gauge theories do, infrared fixed points do exist, but in terms of some strongly coupled E6, for example, for SU3, this thing has some mysterious E6 symmetry, etc. So I'll be concentrating on SU2, which is also the case for the Liouville theory. How am I doing with time?
Don't worry about time. You're the last one.
Go on until next call.
Exactly. Okay. So we identified the theorem of limit, but at this point, maybe I'll briefly stop, because this is all very sort of abstract, and but still, it's a very important motivation
and hints about what kind of underlying structure might be here. But the remarkable thing is that the only input is the existence of this 2.0 theory in six dimensions, and for the rest, I haven't used much. Let me finish up this insight from the 2.0 theory. By identifying observables. So if you would want to study a gauge theory, in particular its electromagnetic properties, you would want to be able to identify useful observables. And I mentioned the Wilson and et Hof loops, but the Wilson et Hof loops are only part of a more general story. And the way to get the observables, just at least to guess what kind of observables might exist, one needs to think about this cell dual string and the various things it could do. So the point that will be important in the following is that besides the loop operators, which are the Wilson and et Hof loops, there are also surface operators that one can consider. And it turns out that in the math literature, people started looking at those things, and Gukov and Witten and also Doma and collaborators have been looking at these things in the gauge theory. But the motivation from the string theory perspective is quite obvious, that if you have your space-time of your Riemann surface times R4, then indeed you could still have an M2 brain that ends on a string in these four dimensions. So the gauge theory in some sense should have natural observables that correspond to the endpoints of the M2 brains. And the way you have to think about them is as magnetic, singular magnetic flux lines, essentially, the vortices are Birkhoff vortices type objects in the gauge theory. So indeed, they are labeled by a magnetic flux. Also, they have some kind of theta angle, which combined parameterizes a two-dimensional set of parameters that tells you, from the M theory perspective, where this M2 brain is localized in the extra dimension. So the surface operator is labeled by a position x on sigma, and this is going to be important for our story. Let me mention one important property, neat, is that this sigma has a non-trivial pi 1. So I can move x around one of the cycles on the Riemann surface. Now, what would that correspond to for the corresponding surface operator? So I mentioned that this thing contains a certain amount of magnetic flux. But there's, of course, a flux unit that is essentially invisible for an Aharonov-Bohm type of experiment. So if I would shift the flux by a quantized unit, then the corresponding surface operator does not change. And that essentially corresponds to moving this point around one of these cycles. So this is a piece of information which is actually still non-trivial from the point of view of the gauge theory, but from the point of view of M theory, it's quite clear that there must be observables that are labeled by points on the internal Riemann surface. Now, then there are line operators, which are the Wilson and Hof loops operators. And as I already mentioned, in the case of the torus, one can have these self-dual strings that wrap around either these cycles or this cycle or some linear combination of it, which would be some dionic objects. But more generally, if I have this Riemann surface, then I could take for any cycle, any element of pi 1 of sigma, I can look at the corresponding string that wraps that particular cycle, and that will give me a point source in four dimensions, but that will still have a world line, that point source, and that world line of the point source is the line operator. But this is a dionic point particle in general. So it could be electrically charged or magnetically charged. And the dions in the theory, the point-like dions that one can introduce in this theory, are labeled by cycles on internal manifold. Again, this follows from the fact that there is this two-dimensional excitation in six dimension, and in this case, one dimension is internal and one dimensional is in four dimensions. There's also point operators. I'll not say too much about it, which were the things that I mentioned before that would wrap one of these type of shapes. And essentially what those point operators do is if you have these line operators, the point operators can be act like a vertex between three of those line operators, where you take the line operators corresponding to these three loops, for example. And this is indeed, if these are all Wilson lines, then that should be a trifundamental quantum, have trifundamental quantum numbers. Okay, now let me quickly sort of follow the historical route from the other end. Okay.
Fully in the Riemann surface and has its boundaries on those three cycles.
Okay. And it would sit, yeah, essentially it's a continuous surface, but it switches dimension at the junction.
So it's something that can make these line operators join.
Now, for people who are familiar with two-dimensional CFT, in particular, this picture here, the picture, the way in which one assigns this particular type of limit to a Riemann surface is familiar to the study of correlation functions in general in two-dimensional conformal field theory. So two-dimensional conformal field theory is the Wolschik theory of a string. And as we know, on the string, rather naturally, if you have massless excitations in two dimensions, they either are left-moving or right-moving. So there's a certain sense in which one can decompose the Hilbert space of the CFT into left- and right-moving parts. So in general, a correlation function of the CFT has, in general, the following form. You can write it as an integral or maybe as a sum. Depends on what kind of CFT one is looking at. Of some function that depends on the shape of the Riemann surface. So consider some Riemann surface, again, say, with a bunch of punctures on it, and I want to consider a correlation function. This thing has a shape, moduli, let me call them mi.
And there's some label, some set of labels that I can choose, which would specify in the conformal field theory what kind of quantum numbers are propagating along tubes. So the way, what one would need to do in order to write down the CFT correlation function in this particular form, where it's the absolute value squared of an analytic expression in terms of the moduli. So the key point, again, is that the moduli space is a complex space. In general, the correlation function depends on those moduli, but in a very special way, where if you assign the appropriate quantum numbers to each of these channels, you go through a diagram like this, and you decide, okay, well, I'm giving a label A1, say, here, A2 here, and these labels depend on the conformal field theory. But once you've found those labels, you can identify holomorphic pieces in your correlation functions. And these things have a name. They're called conformal blocks. So the suspicion that one might have is that the structure that relates these different perturbative limits might be related to the structure that relates these different conformal blocks. Because similarly, as the perturbative limit is not unique for a given Riemann surface, the choice of conformal block is not unique for a Riemann surface, for a given Riemann surface. And in general, what people have developed is a rather powerful way of computing, say, if I have two ways of defining a conformal block corresponding to two ways of writing the Riemann surface in that particular way, then there are some matrices, let me call them just MAB, that would relate the basis that you would choose for one of these perturbative limits, or at least conformal block limits, I would say, in terms of the other one. So there are what we call modular transformations. Yeah, although maybe the better name is actually that these are, we call them actually fusion and braiding matrices. Although they have more general properties than that. Again, two examples of this are what we call the S-duality transformation that relates tau to minus 1 over tau. You could also have what's also called an S-duality transformation. If you have the four-punctured sphere, you can write down the four-punctured sphere like that, or you can write it like that. And this is indeed the fusion process. And there's some matrix again that will relate the choice of quantum number here to the choice of quantum number there. So in pictures, these matrices M, you can think about them as decomposing this conformal block into conformal blocks that look like that.
Riemann surfaces starting with the torus have non-trivial conformal blocks.
Right.
So in this not cyber-written, but cyber-written-like picture, what does the conformal block for the partition function on the torus correspond to? With no functions.
It's a partition function of n equals 4.
It's a partition function of n equals 4, but it still involves an integral over this variable a. And the variable a is an expectation value still. It's not really an expectation value. OK, let me be more precise. Sorry, you're jumping to the gauge theory right now?
Well, I mean, you're drawing these suggestive pictures.
Yeah.
I don't want to jump, but.
Yeah,
I'm trying to understand heuristically how.
Okay, I'm going to. Everything is heuristic, okay. So I'll. I wanted to continue briefly more with the CFT, but I can do the story from both ends, so I don't mind jumping back to the gauge theory. So let's think about this particular part of the structure. And actually, the key insight, and it came from. When these people were essentially suspecting that there must be a way of viewing the Young-Mills partition function in the same language, then by looking at the answers that these people provided, it actually had the same basic structure. Where Nekrasov, He looked on S4, and he didn't consider Wilson lines. And he found expressions that I'll just suggestively write like that, but where this is some instanton sum, but he was able to do the instanton sum, and he found an expression that, more importantly, actually depended holomorphically on the gauge couplings, also on some number A, maybe. The calculation, sorry, you did R. Pastoon did the calculation on S4, and he found, so he looked at the gauge theory partition function, and the gauge theory partition function on the S4 had that particular structure. By the way, he looked more generally at Wilson line expectation values, and this Wilson line you basically have to think about it as follows. So this is S4. This is R4. Sorry, this is S4. And there's an equator, which is S3. And inside of that equator, you could place at a well-chosen location, you could put a Wilson line there. If you put a Wilson line there and you found an interesting, simply a simple expression, I'm not even exactly sure how to, how would I look like. Help me somewhere. Something like that. Post on fire.
For the fundamental.
Sorry?
For the fundamental.
For the fundamental, it looks like that.
And what's the A in this case?
So what the A is, it is actually, because the theory that one is looking at here has a scalar field, and the Wilson line that one has to consider in this case is not a pure Wilson line. One also needs to have a component because it's a supersymmetric Wilson line. So it involves a scalar field in the exponential as well. And this A is the value of the scalar field at the location of the Wilson line. But I want to at least... pi A times sigma 3. I want to mention that if you take the spin 1/2 representation of SU2, and you just compute the character, you find that same thing. So it's essentially just the character of the spin 1/2 representation that's sitting there. So the interpretation of that label A has something to do with the parameter of the Wilson line. But with respect to this structure of the correlation function, the basic interpretation of this answer is that, and this is indeed how the answer comes about, is that there are two natural places for where these instantons are going to sit in the particular calculation that they're doing. So it turns out that there's a bunch of instantons that go and sit on the South Pole, and there's a bunch of instantons that naturally would go and sit on the North Pole. And the reason why they want to sit on the North and the South Pole is because of some deformation that Nekrasov introduces in some symmetry that he imposes. But it's a valid symmetry that is just a trick in doing the path integral. But the key point is that the splitting of the S4 into an upper half, a North Pole, and a South Pole, the North Pole half looks like an R4, and the South Pole half looks like an R4. So in terms of this dictionary here, one would say that if you do gauge theory on R4, you will actually find one of these conformal blocks. Whereas if you do gauge theory on S4, you find the full correlation. Let me briefly mention one important aspect. This matrix, if you would do this transformation in this expression, this matrix M would drop out because it's a unitary matrix. It drops out of this. So this whole expression is modular invariant, whereas the individual conformal blocks are not. So the amazing thing, again, it was found that it have this structure, one could actually identify what kind of conformal block this is, and it turned out to be the conformal block of a Lie real field. Now, Lie real theory had been developed in the last 10 years, maybe, in more specific, with concrete expressions for these conformal blocks. And they're actually pretty complicated expressions. I'm not going to write them on the blackboard, but if you would want to write down those matrices and you want to write down those conformal blocks, I would be filling all the blackboards. So these are long expressions. And also, these calculations of Nekrasov and Festoon are quite heroic. And actually, the identities that one would need to verify that the CFT expressions and the instanton expressions are the same were also non-trivial. So this is a very non-trivial check, but the correspondence is very detailed. But now, essentially, one has a pretty powerful tool available, which I want to summarize, that allows one to do the computation that I dreamed of doing. Yes.
The question is there a difference between the Virasoro conformal block and Liouville theory?
It's hard to say.
The Virasoro conformal block is universal. I mean, I think that's what
you said.
But I mean, they also have things that correspond to external, you know, vertex operators as well. So. If you
okay, so let me explain why it's not possible. So basically, once you're at this stage, it actually becomes clear that one can compute the ad hoc loops. But now there's a boring way of doing it, which actually turns out to be
essentially impossibly hard. And then there's a more inventive way of doing it, which is doable. So here's the boring way. Now the boring way is to assume S duality, right? So if Festoon has told us how to compute the expectation value of a Wilson line, and the very non-trivial result still of Gaiotto, Tachikawa, and Alde is that the fact that these expressions that are the instanton sums look like the conformal blocks of Liouville theory allows one to actually prove that the theory has this S duality invariance. So what I could now do, I could, if I want to know the expectation value of the Hoff loop in this gauge theory, and if I say I want to compute the Hoff loop in a given gauge theory, it means I take a particular perturbative limit, and in that perturbative limit, I'm writing down the usual definition of the Hoff loop, and then I want to know what the answer is. But if you once you know what S duality is, and you assume that the Hoff and the Wilson loops are interchanged under S duality, then the method of computing could be to do the S-duality, compute the Wilson loop, and do the S-duality back. It turns out that that's essentially an impossible computation to do because these matrices are horrendously complicated. But that's actually a better trick. And this goes back to...
...or Microsoft 5 years ago. Is this true? What is the input from the M5
theory? That I'll come to later. So the M5 perspective right now is not necessarily there. I think the M5 brain perspective gave some additional confidence that one should view this really as a smaller group on an appropriate agreement, a geometric space Riemann surface. I don't think that was maybe obvious to them.
But again, looking at the formulas.
The formulas are very complicated. And from the formulas, it's not easy to prove that that they are S-duality in there. For n equals 4 mLs, yes, I think there's more control. Although, even there, one needs to do some non-trivial checks. But the... for example, for these other theories, n equals 2 star and n equals and n equals 4, the expressions are complicated.
But the connection with Louisville, that could be done.
Yeah, let's say this way. There was actually a little bit of a hint here. There's a one loop prefactor that Testum computed that turns out to be precisely the 3-point function of squared of the Louisville theory. And if you had looked at it, you could have recognized that it was the same. But this conformal block was so complicated that it's certainly not a shame that it shouldn't be a shame that it didn't recognize it.
But I mean, did they try and interpret it in terms of two-dimensional CFTs at all? Or?
I don't think that they did at the time.
Yeah, this is a wild question, but does this make contact with the twister theory point of view at some point? I mean, with the
no, I wouldn't think so. It kind of goes orthogonal in that it really looks at the space of all coupling constants, whereas the twister point of view is really doing the perturbative expansion relative to one of the corners. So So it's really just looking at zooming in on one of the tips of this complete space. Of, but I'm sure in the end you'll start talking to each So my own sort of point of recognition when I saw this structure and when we were talking about the Wilson lines was that this particular structure I also seen as a rather natural thing that could be identified in the CFT and that immediately would allow you to recognize a way of doing this, computing the host loop. But let me, before doing that from the CFT perspective, although yeah, I can do the CFT perspective or I can do the five-dimensional perspective, and they talk to each other. You know what? I'll do it both at the same time. Okay, so there was an operation that my brother actually introduced 20 years ago that allowed him to compute many properties of the CFT correlation functions, including fusion rules. Basically, the rules for how, if you take two of these quantum numbers, how they join together, etc. And he used a particular trick defining an operator that was indeed associated with a loop. Now, as I said before, the Wilson and ad hoc loops are naturally associated with loops on the Riemann surface, and the CFT indeed has a natural class of loop operators. Another hint that indeed the operators that my brother was considering is that the loop operators that he was considering had to do with the fusion rule, so that the algebra itself was the representation ring of the CFT. And here you can already see the character of a representation. So you should expect that this thing may have to do, again, with the representation ring of the gauge theory, and that's what Wilson lines do. If you multiply Wilson lines in different representations, you get the Wilson line in the representation ring. Now, you could do this for a general CFT, but let me, it's a general correlation function, but let me do it for the torus, and maybe let me do it for the one function torus. So this is the n equals 2 star theory in the gauge theory language. So this would be the partition function of the CFT. Let me get my chalk here. And we want to know some properties of this thing. And the operation that Eric introduced was the following. Take some operator, let me call it phi. It's some special operator, which I'll mention in a second. It's an operator phi 1. It's a fundamental operator in the CFT, and we want to know associated with some loop operation. And the way to do that is initially we put the identity operator here. Now, if I have a CFT operator, there's a thing called the operator product expansion. That if I take two versions of the same operator, then the identity operator typically appears in the operator product. Or if it doesn't, then there's a conjugate operator that gives me the identity operator. So in terms of pictures, what you do is you take two operators, you put phi star on one of them and phi on the other, and you fuse them together to the identity operator. At this point, I've not done anything. I've just put the identity operator here. Okay. Now, let me make a dictionary. And at the moment, actually, I'll make the dictionary by formulating a certain conjecture. The conjecture is that I need a local operator in the gauge theory, an operator in the gauge theory that corresponds to a local operator in the CFT. And the conjecture is that a surface operator in the gauge theory corresponds to the insertion of an operator of this insertion of this operator. Let's assume that such an operator exists for now. Now, let's be a little bit careful about this because I have to be specific whether I'm talking about the gauge theory on R4 or the gauge theory on S4. But for the moment, I can deal with both cases. In the one case, this thing is a chiral Quercus operator. In the other case, this is a non-chiral Quercus operator. So what I'll start to do, I'll do the same operation that he's doing here in the gauge theory. So I take my surface operator, so this is my surface operator in the gauge theory. I take a second one at the same location, but this one is the anti-surface operator of that guy, and I annihilate them. But now the idea is that I want to start creating a Wilson line. Now the way I would do that on this side is I would take a Wilson line, and the Wilson line I can, or a Wilson and Hausdorff operator. Let me do the Hausdorff. So what I want to do, I want to act with an Hausdorff loop on that surface operator. And I can do that at a special time, say at time, if this is time t, I can act on it at time t equals 0. And I'll act on it on one of the two operators. Now, what does that correspond to? Now, the Hausdorff loop, as we know, creates a magnetic monopole. And the magnetic monopole has a quantized Dirac string attached to it. So it creates a quantized unit of magnetic flux. Now, as I told you, is that the surface operator itself is a magnetic, it's like a Bricusov flux tube itself. So if I act on it with a Hausdorff loop, what happens to that flux tube, actually the amount of flux in that flux tube jumps by a quantized unit, but at this particular location, okay? Now, what that actually corresponds to is the following. So this Hausdorff loop naturally splits this operator into an upper and a lower half. And the idea, the basic point is that on S4, if I have the surface operator that now lives here, that the upper and the lower half of the surface operator correspond to the decomposition of this operator phi 1 into the product of the left mover phi 1 left times phi 1 right in the conformal field theory, where left corresponds to the south pole and right corresponds to the north hemisphere. Now, if I act on the surface operator with an Hausdorff loop, this amounts to, again, a discrete jump in the flux here relative to the flux there, but the surface operator has a position on the Riemann surface that is the flux, and if I do a jump on it, it amounts to moving that half of the operator around the Riemann surface, a cycle on the Riemann surface. So what I need to do in order to act with the Hausdorff loop, I need to take a chiral operator, this phi 1 guy, and I need to transport it around a cycle on the Riemann surface. This is indeed precisely the operation that Eric at the time introduced. What he did in the conformal field theory, he wrote down the two operators like that. He did a transformation like this. This is a non-trivial transformation, because I've now redrawn this diagram. But now I can move this guy around. And then one ends up with the two operators in the opposite order. Actually, I think one has to go all the way back here, although it doesn't matter. What you do after you move all around, you refuse it again to the identity operator. And it turned out that this is a non-trivial operation that one can define on the space of conformal blocks. And Eric proved that this thing satisfies the fusion ring, this operation satisfies the representation ring of the CFT. In this case, what it would correspond to is indeed you take
the two service operators that initially are each other's conjugate. You act with the Hopf loop on one of them, and then you annihilate them. And in the end, of course, you're left just with the Hopf loop sitting in space. So if I just want to compute the expectation value of the Hopf loop, I can do this particular operation. So this is the computation that we've actually done in the Liouville theory, and this allows you to compute the expectation value of the Hopf loop. Just to wrap up, in the last 30 seconds, let me finally talk about gravity. Liouville theory, of course, was gravity, but let me mention a small, or at least a relevant observation related to 2 plus 1 gravity. So there are these loop operators. Associated with loops in the pi 1 of your Riemann surface. Now, Liouville theory, I didn't say too much about it, but it has a Lagrangian. And if you look at the equation of motion that you get out of this, if you think about phi as being the conformal factor of a metric, two-dimensional metric, then the equation of motion of the Liouville theory corresponds to taking the two-dimensional curvature to be some negative number mu, I guess. So the space of classical solutions of the Liouville theory is the space of constant curvature metrics on your Riemann surface. So now the space of constant curvature metrics on the Riemann surface is the moduli space of Riemann surfaces. Or another name for it is Teichmuller space, although the difference between Teichmuller space and the moduli space precisely has to do with these moduli transformations. So the phase space, for all practical purposes, one can identify of Liouville theory. It's Teichmuller space. And also, roughly 20 years ago, I indeed made a conjecture that if one would start with Teichmuller space, which is a finite dimensional space, that one can actually define a rather natural complex structure on it, or a symplectic structure, if you like. So it's a symplectic manifold. So you can actually quantize it. And indeed, Liouville theory provides a natural value of h bar for this quantization of Teichmuller space. Now, Teichmuller space essentially can be written as the space of flat SL2R gauge fields. Essentially by having a Zwei bind, E plus, E minus, and a spin connection, you can write the constant curvature this equation as an SL2R, flatness of SL2R gauge fields. And it turns out that a rather natural set of quantum observables that you can define on this Teichmuller space is precisely by doing a trace in the spin 1/2 representation of SL2R. Of a Wilson line, but now of this, let me call this, that was a good name for it, curly A. Whatever, that's my gauge field. So there's an SL2R gauge field that's defined on your Riemann surface. You can take its contour integral around some cycle gamma. And this turns out to be the cosine, the cosh of the length, geodetic length of the corresponding cycle of gamma divided by 2. But these are natural operators that one can define on this particular phase space. But the symplectic structure is such that if I define those operators for loops that do not intersect, then the corresponding operators commute. But if the loops do intersect, then the corresponding operators do not commute. So if you would want to go to an from an eigenbasis of one set of non-commuting set of operators to an eigenbasis of the other set of non-commuting, of mutually commuting operators, but not commuting with the original set, then you have to do a canonical transformation between the two. And my conjecture was that these fusion matrices are the things that will tell you how to relate all these things, these diagrams, these conformal blocks, is given by that basis transformation. Or another way of saying is that the conjecture was that the Liouville conformal blocks form the Hilbert space that one finds as a result of quantizing this space of negative third manifolds. Teschner actually proved this particular conjecture. So he actually really computed these basis transformations, and he showed that they are the same, have the same structure as the So to summarize, at least once you have this particular relation between the Liouville theory and the gauge theory, for people have done obviously hard work in establishing this relationship, and people have done hard work in solving Liouville theory. But in the end, without doing any additional hard work, once this relationship has been established, it indeed immediately kicks out very useful information. And as an example here, I gave the computation of the expectation value of the Hilbert loop operators. Let me just briefly mention what the basic structure of the Hilbert loop operator expectation value is, because you'll actually recognize it. So for the case of the n=2 star theory, what one finds is that it essentially, so the Hilbert loop operator looks like this. The A F star A F A plus pi over 2 plus with some pre-coefficient. Roughly like that. And indeed, one can recognize this as the expression that one would get if I would act, rather than with cosine pi a, I would act on this rather on this guy on the right with an operator, let me call it cosine pi a check, where a check is the canonical conjugate, and maybe there's some 2 pi's here. 1/2 pi, I'm making a guess. So it has a canonically conjugate variable, indeed one can recognize that this will look like that. But the way we computed it is by doing this operation that Eric defined of moving this operator along those cycles. And the way we knew that the answer had to be this is the right definition of the Hilbert loop operator, is that if you indeed do Eric's operation on the A cycle, meaning around the cycle corresponding to the Wilson loop, you find this answer. And then geometrically, you know that the right operation on the dual cycle is then the Hilbert loop. I would say that, okay, so the gauge theory computation would proceed as follows, is that I have this conjecture that if one could establish this particular guy, which may not be easy, then I would call this an independent gauge theory computation. Then this would be a check of S duality. So our structure basically shows that if this conjecture is equivalent to the S duality of the Hilbert and Wilson loops. And the reason for that is that the operation that I'm doing here to define the Hof loop does not involve any S-duality transformation. Here I define the Hof loop by means of doing this manipulation, this monodreaming operation, moving it around this cycle. But I'm never doing a modular transformation. So I'm not putting in S-duality. S-duality is a check. Now, there are many open problems. The most interesting one is, why does Liouville wheel theory come out of n equals 2 gauge theory? The wild, at least, there's some structure here with Hitchin equations, all kinds of other structure that might hint at something. OK, even if one would understand how Liouville wheel theory comes about here, is this a hint of, is this telling us what non-critical string theory really is in M theory? Maybe not. Are there generalizations to SUN, which is more complex? But does this teach us anything about the M5 Rain world volume? What about other four manifolds? Because the fact that we got Liouville theory is really based on this choice of four manifold. In principle, for every four manifold, you get a different two-dimensional conformal field theory, and you play the same game for other four manifolds. And there's a much longer list of other things. Okay, let me stop there.
Any final questions?
Do you expect that any computation in any observable in any particular tool would be mapped to some observable?
Not any observables. So the fact that one gets the Liouville theory out of this still clearly still seems like a reduction in the number of degrees of freedom of the 4D theory. And the reason for why you're not seeing everything in the 4D theory is because the computations that are being made use of here, of Pastoon and Nekrasov, they assume a certain localization in the path integral that restricts the side type of observables that they can use, and they have to be invariant under certain U1 symmetry. So all the observables, you know, the guess would basically be that all the observables that are invariant under that U1 symmetry can probably be captured by this Liouville theory, but as soon as you would have other observables that would break the U1 symmetry, probably pop out.
It's more than the U1, you need supersymmetry.
Yeah, it needs supersymmetry. Yeah, so it needs to, as I said, it needs to commute with a supersymmetry generator that squares to the U1 generator. So it needs to commute both with the supersymmetry and with the U1 generator. Yes. Although the surprising thing is actually that the Liouville theory is not supersymmetric. It's not n equals 2 Liouville theory, which also exists, but somehow.
Probably completely what you said, but there's, I can see at least three SO2Z actions in the various places. And so we start off with it, S duality, electromagnetic. Then you've got LX, S and T transformations, S generating SO2Z. And you've got this flat as a draw connections, and there's a quantum group sitting there, UQSO2, which has an associated S and T generator generating an SO2Z action. Are they all connected?
Yeah, I would say the some of them are representations of the other ones.
In ways that you understand, or?
In ways that Teschner understands.
The central charge of the
UV. Yeah, so the central charge of the UV is so much mysterious. The one that comes out naturally from the geometric setup turns out to be CD equals 25 Liouville theory, which is the Liouville theory that you need to define C equals 1 string theory. Although, again, one of the mysterious things here is that we're not integrating over the modular space agreement surface itself. The modular space parameter is actually is a visible parameter in the whole story. Although I should say that all of this structure associated with the Wilson and the Hof loops is very topological. Essentially, the way the expectation values come about do not depend on the gauge couplings. So the gauge coupling depends in some senses very topological in itself also, which is why epoch-formal field theories can be studied from the point of view of topological field theory also. What was your question again?
What is central charge?
Central charge. Yeah, so sequence 25. Now one can move away from sequence 25 by doing a sort of a more general calculation that Nekrasov indeed did, where he introduced certain twists labeled by epsilon 1 and epsilon 2 at two parameters. And if the ratio of those two parameters is not equal to 1, you can actually move away in the partition sum away from sequence 25. But it's not well understood really what that deformation corresponds to in the case here. It could be that it's a deformation of the instanton sum, but it's not really a deformation of the field theory in a way that's well understood.
Okay, let's thank Dominika.